This amendment is offered by Councilman Stern, Appalachia.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Dan Mahler, and I represent Appellant LaBella Donna Skincare. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
5 minutes.
This is a fraudulent conveyance case where the circuit court improperly granted summary judgment and sustained a demur despite multiple disputes of fact. If this decision stands, the integrity of civil judgments in this Commonwealth will be harmed, and this case will operate as a roadmap for judgment debtors seeking to evade civil judgments across Virginia. I will assume that the court is familiar with the overall facts, but there are certain facts regarding the foreclosure that I think it's important to focus on. Here, the timeline is critical. The Belladonna's judgment from the underlying trial was entered on September 28, 2012. 3 days later, the law firm foreclosed on its promissory note, despite regular monthly payments from its client. Now, 7 days later, the law firm, 3 days after the judgment, the law firm called the note, and 7 days later, the law firm foreclosed upon the upon its client's assets. Upon this foreclosure, the law firm took a financial interest in its client's business. Now, this foreclosure acted as a shield against a later LaBella Donna execution on the judgment. 9 days after the law firm foreclosed on their promissory note, the law firm created a new company for its client, for the judgment debtors to operate. Now, one day after this new company was created, Bonair, the old entity, drained their bank accounts, sent thousands of dollars out to various parties, money that could have been used to pay off the law firm's debt, but it was not. One day after these bank accounts were drained, LaBella Donna's judgment became final. It was only at that point that LaBella Donna could have executed on its judgment. That timeline, I think, is critical in this case.
Well, it could have executed on the judgment. It just would have done it at its peril.
Yes.
The fraudulent conveyance count was kicked out on demur, right?
Summary judgment, Your Honor.
Summary judgment.
Circuit court granted summary judgment on the fraudulent conveyance count, and the circuit court granted demurs on the civil and statutory conspiracy counts.
So if fraudulent conveyance were to survive or should have survived summary judgment or demur or whatever, then that drops a lot of dominoes with the other causes of action, I take it.
I believe so, Your Honor. The bottom line is that the fraudulent conveyance should have survived and should have gone to trial, and the civil conspiracy and statutory conspiracy counts should have gone to trial as well. I have three legal points here. I'm going to start with, again, the fraudulent conveyance. Here, the circuit court made a classic error of fraudulent conveyance analysis. It focused on just one part of the transaction, the pre-existing lien. What the circuit court should have done is step back and look at the entire transaction. The legal question this court needs to answer today regarding this count is whether a pre-existing lien excuses a later fraudulent conveyance as a matter of law. And the answer is no, it cannot.
Right now, for the sake of our clarity, the law firm that you refer to is the law firm for the judgment debtor.
That's correct.
For the sake of clarity, when you're talking about the fraudulent conveyance, what conveyance are you referring to?
Your Honor, I think there's when you look at fraudulent conveyance analysis, you look at the overall transaction. I would specifically point to the foreclosure by the law firm upon the client's assets. Effectively, that's what stopped LaBella Donna from executing.
So, again, and this is in interest of clarity, the law firm took an interest in the assets of the judgment debtor with a note and secured it by the assets of Bonair Med.
Correct.
And also made it payable on demand, which they did very quickly, and then sought to foreclose. So that is the conveyance you're talking about.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, go ahead.
Well, let me ask you this. What about the conveyance of the the bookings, et cetera, to the spouses and other relatives? You don't think those conveyances were fraudulent?
I think they were, Your Honor.
Well, you just told the chief that you didn't think there were but one.
Well, I think there were multiple fraudulent conveyances in this case, Your Honor. And when you look at a fraudulent, when you look at the overall transaction, the overall goal of this transaction was to move the assets.
Can I stop you for a second?
Sure.
That's why I believe that the Chief Justice asked you the questions. What was the fraudulent conveyance? Was it one? Were there many?
I apologize, Your Honor, if I misheard you. I think that the foreclosure and the law firm taking an interest in its client's business and then transferring the assets back to insiders of the debtor, this is all one large fraudulent conveyance. Now, we can, depending on how we slice and dice the conveyance, we can point to this specific act and that specific act. And the bottom line is that there are multiple red flags here. But the overall point of this transaction was to move the assets from Bonaire, the original entity, launder them through the law firm to cleanse it of the unsecured debt, and return the assets back to insiders of the original debtor.
Which is your conspiracy count.
Exactly.
So, I mean, your point is all of these little points of badges of fraud seen in context, allegedly, amounts to a conspiracy, and you should have a trial on it.
Exactly, Your Honor.
But the reason why you have to be very specific about what conveyance is because the trial judge ruled that there was no fraudulent conveyance when the conveyance preferred a senior creditor as opposed to a junior creditor. And Justice Goodwin is saying, well, hold on, there are other conveyances here, aren't there? And that's why it's important for you to identify, rather than one big amorphous transaction, the trial judge's ruling was that a fraudulent conveyance is not properly found when a creditor prefers a senior, when a party prefers a senior creditor over a non-secured creditor. But that only applies to one aspect of this case.
Your Honor, yes, it does apply to one aspect. Now, part of our argument is that the circuit court made an error of law when it made that conclusion. But we can also point to the transfer of the client of the advanced bookings and the client customer list, which went from Bonaire to Belle Femme, and effectively it went the day that the new company was stood up for business. The new company was formed on October 17, 2012.
Now, if you look at the status of it all, Bonaire Med consists of Mrs. Miller, Mrs. Smoot, and Mrs. Boyd. Belle Femme consists of Mr. Miller, Mr. Smoot, and Mr. Boyd.
Exactly, Your Honor.
All right, go ahead.
Exactly. The client asset, the advanced client bookings, and the customer list are the two most important assets for a business of this kind. When the new company stood up for business on October 17th, it began using those assets immediately. Those assets never appeared on the later auction list, which occurred on December 5th, 2012. It's our position that the new company took those assets without paying adequate consideration for those assets and began to use it immediately. That is another example of a fraudulent conveyance in this case.
And it factors into your successor liability theory as well.
Exactly, Your Honor. Exactly. Now, the idea of using a friendly lien to strip out unsecured debt is an old scheme. We've cited multiple cases in our briefing, which goes back to the 1913 decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, and as recent as the 1990 decision from the Third Circuit in Volst-Alpine versus Vantage Steel. That Third Circuit decision is remarkable because the facts are so similar to the case that we have here. In that case, a foreclosure at 5 p.m. on a Friday afternoon, assets are then sold from the bank to a new company owned by the husband and wives of the old debtors, and the new business begins on Monday morning. The Third Circuit called this a, quote, sham transaction and held it to be a fraudulent conveyance. That is exactly what happened here in this case. Moreover, when you look outside of Virginia regarding the friendly lien, already 44 states recognize that a pre-existing lien does not necessarily excuse a later fraudulent conveyance. That friendly lien has an important limiting principle in it that I think warrants this court's attention. Now, I'm conscientious of my time. I'd like to move on briefly to the conspiracy count. The legal question that this court needs to answer is whether a fraudulent conveyance is a sufficient predicate act for a conspiracy claim in Virginia. And the answer is yes, it is. The third amended complaint alleged the fraudulent transfer of cash, money, and other tangible items. Fraudulent conveyance is a tort. And as this court ruled in Price v. Hawkins in 1994, a money damages judgment is an appropriate remedy in certain circumstances for a fraudulent conveyance.
Let me ask you about that. What about the when there is a conspiracy, say, for instance, like in this instance, and no money changes hands, like it's just a transaction to convey a piece of property,
say,
or something?
Say real estate, Your Honor.
Okay. And so you have a conspiracy cause of action. How would you ever prove damages?
Your Honor, just off the top of my head, my first instinct would be to look at the value of the property and use that as your measure of damages. However, real estate is not something that was transferred in this case, but I do think that...
And I use real estate, but it could be stock in a corporation. It could be anything that's not money, because the only exception we've made concerns actual cash money. So if it's something other than that, I just wondered, if you had a conspiracy claim, what does that get you, you know, as far as damages go?
In a situation where there's not the fraudulent conveyance of cash money, ultimately, Your Honor, I do think that the logic of this position does require that a conspiracy claim will be recognized in situations where real property is transferred.
I'm not sure I've seen you argue this, but in answer to his question, wouldn't the diminution in the value of the assets be a measurable damage? Because it reduces your ability to collect on the judgment.
Yes, Your Honor, and...
But let me ask you this. How do you figure out what that value is? Because you were not entitled to that money. You were just another creditor in line, and whether you were going to be the first creditor or the second creditor or whatever, all you really lost was your chance to try to attach that property.
Your Honor, ultimately...
Just like everybody else is trying to do.
Ultimately, that is going to be a question of fact that's settled by...
Yeah, it's going to be a proximate cause problem.
True.
But it seems like whoever's trying to prove damage is going to have.
Expert witnesses, most likely. And but those kinds of issues are litigated every day in circuit courts across the Commonwealth. Your Honor, if I may turn briefly to the successor liability claims, that was the claim that went to trial. And we believe that the circuit court made an error of law in that case, regarding that claim, by concluding that the transaction was a bona fide transaction. That conclusion of a bona fide transaction is a legal conclusion, just like the Scrivener's error conclusion in this court's decision in Westgate versus Williams Condo. This court can take de novo review of that successor liability claim.
Can I ask you this? Under your understanding of the successor liability count, would the defendant corporation have successor liability even if you couldn't go forward on your independent fraudulent conveyance court?
Yes, Your Honor, because they're separate claims.
So that would provide the full remedy against the successor corporate entity that you're looking for, would it not?
Well, it would provide the remedy against the successor entity to the extent that it can be paid. But it would not provide the conspiracy damages or the treble damages or attorney's fees that would come along with the statutory business conspiracy. And let me just point out as a policy point, to the extent that we want to try to deter this kind of conduct, it's important to deter the professionals who facilitate these kinds of transactions. And that's where the conspiracy liability allows you to deter that kind of conduct.
You had requested 5 minutes, and I always try to help out lawyers when they're wise enough to ask. You have 1 minute and 39 seconds left. You can use it any way you like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will save it for rebuttal.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Ben Tyree. I represent the appellees in this case, Bonair Med Spa, Beltham Enterprises, Molly Smoot, Brooke Miller, Betty Boyd, Jason Miller, Anthony Boyd, and Dan Smoot. I intend to use 10 minutes of the time allotted to the appellees and the remainder to co-counsel. I'll first address the summary judgment on the fraudulent conveyance count. In this matter, Lavella Donahue's, the plaintiff, did not establish any badge of fraud, which is under the Foxress case. The alleged badges that the appellant put forth in its brief, I'll address briefly, the pursuit of transport by a creditor. If the court adopts the plaintiff's position in this case, any any payment to a defense attorney during litigation subjects that attorney and the defendant to a potential fraudulent conveyance claim simply by securing representation. The same can be said for any other paying any other debt.
But don't we have a lot more in this case? I mean, this is, and it seems to me highly unusual what happened here. It's not simply, well, you owe us money, we're going to foreclose, and then here we are. I mean, they're engineering the creation of a new entity, and right?
Well, your point's well taken, Justice, but I respectfully disagree that there is more than that to it. This is essentially litigation between two small businesses, one of which is fledgling, and by the time this the initial litigation had started, the Bonnier Med Spa had only been in business for a couple months. As far as creation of the new entity, that was done by Belfem Enterprises. The Belladonna alleges that Ayers and Stolte facilitated doing that, and you'll see from our brief that Mark Schmidt, who is the lead attorney in the underlying litigation, approached Mr. Boyd, a local businessman, to see if he was willing to do that.
How would he approach Mr. Boyd instead of Mrs. Boyd?
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, and I guess that's where it kind of gets kind of weird, because if he wasn't trying to, you know, destroy success of corporate liability, why would you just go back to the same people? It's like, we're going to foreclose, but we'll let you keep the assets. All you got to do is sign a new note.
Well, I think if they did that, that would put us squarely in the realm of fraudulent conveyance.
Why? What would be fraudulent about that?
Well, some of the cases...
Be completely transparent.
I understand. Some of the cases that have been cited in the brief and the reply brief, the facts are very similar to that, where the debtor is allowed to keep the assets going forward. And essentially, that would be the courts in the past have found that that is exactly the appropriate factual scenarios for.
Yeah, but especially if you sell it to them, which is what you eventually did, what Mr. Smith eventually did to Mr. Boyd instead of Mrs. Boyd.
Correct, and I hope the court recognizes the nature of the businesses here, which is small business that is relationship and service driven. So. In order to maintain the value of this business and Ayers and Stolte acting as a self-interested creditor, they had to ensure that this business would maintain, go forward.
But that's why we have trials, to make exactly those kinds of arguments, that it's really good faith, there's no wrong, malicious intent. This went off on summary judgment. And the question is not, is this fraudulent advance as a matter of law, or is this not fraudulent advance as a matter of law, is could a rational person sitting in a jury seat or a rational trial judge sitting as fact finder under the appropriate legal principles conclude it was a fraudulent advance? And that's the part I don't understand about your argument. Why couldn't some rational juror come to the conclusion this was a huge scheme? This was not just an innocent security interest to get fees paid. We all know what that looks like.
Certainly, and I understand your question, and I believe the answer to it lies with the Rule 411 admissions that were submitted to La Belladonna and admitted. That's on page 26 of my client's brief. It went through and admitted essentially every element that would make this a bona fide transaction. And
the problem is that there's a real good reason why the law firm went to Mr. Boyd instead of Mrs. Boyd. Mrs. Boyd had a judgment against her. You don't want to put the assets in her name. This is going to get collected that way. Why isn't that just as clear a badge of fraud as there could possibly be in this case?
Well, I guess I'm confused. What would be the badge of fraud there in your scenario?
Well, I get to ask the questions, as long as you said so. In the case of Foxrest versus Little, fascinating case in 2011, there are six badges of fraud, and I see in this case at least three. Retention of an interest in the transferred property by the transferor. There's one. Transfer between family members for alleged antecedent debt. I think they had the opportunity to prove that. Whether they do is another matter. Pursuit of the transferor or threat of litigation by creditors at the time of the transfer. There's one. Lack of or gross inadequacy of consideration for the conveyance. When you're out on summary judgment, you don't have the chance to prove it, but they ought to have the chance. Retention or possession of the property by the transferor, and fraudulent incurrence of indebtedness after the conveyance. How does this case go out on summary judgment when there are so many factual issues that remain to be resolved?
Well, Judge, I don't believe there was no retention by the transporter here. Bonnier Vet Spa, after transferring the security interest, of course, for the duration of that of the underlying lawsuit in 2011 or 2012, they didn't retain that. Ayers & Stoltz took that security interest. They properly foreclosed on it, noticed a duly noticed public auction, and bought the assets there. All that was admitted to by the plaintiff here pursuant to Rule 411. And paragraph B to Rule 411 of this court provides that anything admitted to is conclusively established for the case. So if they were admitting to each element of a bona fide transaction, that defeats the...
But did they admit that the timing of the foreclosure wasn't part of the scheme? In other words, it's one thing to say, well, sure, you represented these folks. I mean, we were your opposing party in the lawsuit, and of course you generated fees. You don't work for free. So, yeah, there's this antecedent debt, and it was secured, but they're making regular payments on the debt, and the timing of the foreclosure so as to preclude collecting on the judgment is suspicious. So in conjunction with all the other facts, we get to try to prove to a jury that it was all fraudulent.
I understand that, and I hesitate to speak for Mr. Blackburn's client, which is the law firm. However, I believe you'll see from the brief, as far as the regular payments being made to the law firm pre-foreclosure, there was an additional assignment of proceeds from a living social agreement, which were not made. That's a payment that the law firm was expecting in the summer of 2012. And did not receive that. So while they were making those $1,000 a month payments toward their note, their breach of that agreement, I believe, is what ultimately led to the foreclosure.
Right, but it still goes back to what I think we've all been struggling with, which is you have a perfectly sensible narrative. And I may well, you know, when I hear everybody, if I were the juror, I'd say, you know what, there's just no issue there. But they have an awfully persuasive narrative on the other side. But it was cut short at summary judgment.
I understand that, and I believe this case was tailor-made for summary judgment due to those 411 admissions that we have. Those, again, are conclusively established in this case, and they essentially admitted each element of a bona fide transaction through true indebtedness, so there's it's a legitimate creditor, distinct from several of the other cases, and they admitted that the security interest was granted to Ayers & Stoltz, admitted so forth and so on all the way through auction. And the most important admission is that Ayers & Stoltz purchased those assets at auction. If this was a fraudulent conveyance, which the plaintiff alleges that it is, that would be impossible because that transaction would have been void. So therefore, Ayers & Stoltz could not have purchased good title to those assets at auction.
Well, were the customer lists part of the intangible assets sold at auction?
Yes, I believe they were. Even though they were not specifically listed in the list of assets, they were, as my brief says, resident on the computers, which were listed.
Yeah, that's a pretty oblique way of telegraphing that perhaps one of the most valuable assets. Well, if you buy the computers and you search the hard drives that could be in there, that's quite different from saying, well, here's the...
Well, we have, Justice, we have no value on those assets. And I'll note that at the time summary judgment was granted, the deadline to appoint or to nominate expert witnesses had already passed. So there was no possible way that La Belladonna, in this case, could establish what the value of that asset
is. But it has some value, clearly.
Well, we don't know what that value is, so we certainly don't know that it's one of the most valuable.
It wasn't listed as an asset, was it not? You listed it, I think, as a computer, but you didn't list the customer lists that were earlier appropriated?
Those weren't. The customer list was not specifically listed on the list of items.
Okay, well, then someone going to an auction is not thinking that they're going to be paying for that. They may end up opening up a basket and finding it, but that's not what they're buying.
No, I understand that. And if that were a concern of La Belladonna here, who's present and attended that auction, he certainly had the opportunity to make that inquiry and chose not to do so. I'm running very short of time here,
what
so I'd like to move on.
The inquiry is, well, I want you to take your hard drive out and show me an index of everything that's on it.
Well, the inquiry would be, is the customer list part of what's being transferred here? And the answer is,
you look at the inventory that you're given at auction, and it's not. It's not.
I'm sorry?
You look at the inventory that you're given when you show up at the auction. Isn't that the way it normally works?
Well, I believe general intangibles were listed. And, of course, customer lists would be an intangible. The client relationships would be an intangible. Those were certainly listed and transferred at auction.
Is it true that the appointment list of the predecessor company was acquired somehow by the successor company and generated substantial income in the first several months?
Absolutely not. There was nothing transferred directly from Bonnier Med Spa to Beltham Enterprise.
It was leased.
I'm sorry?
It was subject to a lease. They got everything. The moment that this thing stopped, the law firm had a... When the judgment was entered, the law firm created a lease arrangement and leased everything.
Correct.
To the new corporation or new entity that they created, which the plaintiffs allege was for the purpose of putting the assets out of reach of a judgment creditor.
The purpose of doing that was so the law firm could get paid.
There's lots of ways to get paid, but if you do it in a manner that violates a fraudulent conveyance statute, that's why we have courts to resolve that.
I understand that, and I don't believe this was. I'm encroaching on Mr. Blackburn's time here, so I'd like to cut.
Well, why don't you let Mr. Blackburn come up?
All right, thank you.
In police court, Joe Blackburn on behalf of Ayers and Stolte and Charles Ayers. And I want to jump in initially, and really the issue here is you had two small companies, and there's a lawsuit that has the ability to put a company out of business. On the day before trial, there are $50,000 in fees owed to Ayers and Stolte. What do? They take a promissory note and security interest. There's a big judgment, and there are no assets left. And what they do after that is they make steps to recover their legal fees. In each step, they've admitted, and it's not clear exactly what the conveyance is that is fraudulent here, but I think their admissions prove that each one isn't. They had a valid debt when they took the security interest and promissory note before the trial.
Can I interrupt you for a second? You say there are no assets left. What about the customer list?
There are assets, but the value of those assets, the value of the customer list in a services business is who you have working for you. They talk about the advanced bookings. Those people are making bookings because they want to go to see that esthetician. It's not a business flush with assets that somebody can levy on. It's a situation where you've got three estheticians.
But in a service industry business like this, I would guess that the customer list would be a substantial portion of the goodwill value of the entity.
And it is, but it's not. If you're levying on the assets and these estheticians leave, there really is no goodwill. The goodwill is driven by the company, the people you go to see to provide those services.
Which is exactly why it seems to me that if I were a law firm and I'm trying to maximize my recovery on this foreclosure, I sell the assets back to the estheticians who can actually take advantage of them because they're going to be worth more to them than to anyone else.
And that's what they did.
Well, except for it was to their husbands and to their sons and to other people, which cuts off the success of corporate liability. And that's what makes it look, or at least colorable, that the purpose of doing this was to make sure that LaBella Donna didn't collect on their judgment.
Well, I mean, what they did...
As opposed to the law firm just trying to maximize its recovery.
Well, I understand, but you've got a business that has a $400,000 judgment against them. It's a service business that has no assets. They're not going to keep operating. It's just a fact of life that they're not going to spend every day going to work to pay a judgment.
Apparently did pretty well with their successor corporation.
Well, and they did, and they took steps to find a way to make money. And each step of the conveyance, though, was, based on their admissions, was proper. The auction, it was noticed. It was publicly noticed. They sent a specific letter to LaBella Donna, a competitor, who they wanted to be at the auction. They bid $10,000 for the assets. LaBella Donna, they didn't place a bid. They could have. The law firm would have loved to have sold the assets for more than that at the auction if they could. They can't. The law firm can't do anything with spa supplies unless somebody puts them to use to make money. So what you have here is a situation where a small company that has a huge judgment against them. You've got two creditors. Ayers and Stolte is a secured creditor. They're first in line no matter what. They could have foreclosed on the assets, but they would have been subject to Ayers and Stolte's prior claim.
But they became secured after the judgment.
No, they became secured before
the trial. That's right. In the face of the trial, you're exactly right. In the face of the trial where a judgment was possible to be rendered and was, in fact, thereafter rendered.
That's correct. But if it was a situation where the business had $85,000 in cash and that's their only asset, they could certainly pay those fees to their lawyer before a judgment is entered and it wouldn't be a fraudulent conveyance. Here they had no cash. They didn't have the cash to pay him, so they took the security interest. I see that I'm out of time.
All right.
Thank you.
Your time has expired. Rebuttal?
Very briefly, Your Honor. First of all, according to the appellees, the law firm wanted to be paid, and they were self-interested creditors, but the new business generated significant cash. The new business generated $54,000 in revenue in the first 2 months it operated, and over the first 2 years of the new business's operation, it paid $79,000 in, quote, equity distributions to the husbands and the family members of the judgment debtors.
Driven, no doubt, by the appointment list and the customer list.
Exactly. Second of all, I believe there was an argument made of essentially the sky will fall if we allow a fraudulent conveyance case claim to go forth in this case, specifically that any payment by a losing party to its attorney will be a fraudulent conveyance. That has not been borne out by history. Outside of Virginia, at least 26 states recognize conspiracy liability for fraudulent conveyances, and of those 26 states, which are set forth in the Joint Appendix, seven of those states specifically recognize conspiracy liability against attorneys.
Before we run out of time, address the successful admissions argument that you requested yourself out of going to trial.
Certainly, Your Honor. That is not the case. Our request for our admissions did not request us out or did not admit our way out of court. The most serious admission is number 22, which describes the priority of their security interest to our judgment lien. We admitted that that security interest was recorded earlier than our judgment lien. There's no question about that. But that's the most serious thing that we admitted was that their lien came before our judgment. And the law of fraudulent conveyance is clear is that a mere pre-existing lien does not, as a matter of law, cut off or excuse a subsequent fraudulent conveyance.
Well, your position is that all that may be so, and we may have admitted it, but the error that was committed by the trial court was a decision that a transfer of secured assets to a priority lien holder cannot, under any circumstances, be a fraudulent conveyance. And that's what you maintain here.
Exactly, Your Honor. That is a glaring error of law. Thank you.
All right. Call the next case.